From New York Public Radio, this is the podcast of On the Media. On the Media is produced by WNYC and heard across America on NPR stations. Visit onthemedia.org to find your local public radio station. This podcast is made possible by WNYC and its listeners. Please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org.
From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. When Syria withdrew its last soldier from Lebanon this past April after nearly three decades of occupation, outsiders could be forgiven for thinking that Lebanon was on the brink of a new era of democratic rule. But this week we were reminded that transitions often come at a cost. On Monday, the editor and publisher of the prominent newspaper Al-Nahar was killed when a car bomb blew his SUV off a cliff in a Beirut suburb. Gibran Tweny's assassination was the latest in a string of recent attacks on journalists in Lebanon. In fact, Tweny had just returned from a few months in Paris, a trip prompted by death threats. Suspicion fell immediately on the regime of Syrian President Bashar al-Assad, currently in the crosshairs of a UN probe into another assassination, that of former Lebanese Prime Minister Rafik Hariri. Like Hariri, Tweny had been one of Assad's most outspoken critics. Joining me now from Beirut is Michael Young, opinion editor for the Lebanon Daily Star. Michael, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Tell me first, please, about Gibran Tweny and his family.
Well, I mean, the Tweny family is a prominent newspaper family in Beirut, a Greek Orthodox family. Gibran's grandfather, who is also named Gibran, founded the family's paper, Al-Nahar. But it was really Gibran's father, Ghassan, who, starting in the 1950s, turned it into the national institution it is today. It's embraced a lot of very different ideologies amongst its very varied staff. So that in a rather strange way, by embracing these different points of views, it also managed to retain its independence vis-a-vis all of them. And I think that's the real genius of the family. They've managed to give a newspaper an identity in support of democracy, of free speech. At the same time, they've also managed to allow a lot of people who don't necessarily share their views to write in it.
After Hariri was killed and the Syrians left, Tweny was elected to the Lebanese parliament on Hariri's ticket. Do you think Tweny was perceived more as a journalist or as a political figure?
Always very much of both. I mean, you know, journalists in Lebanon are also often political figures. I mean, you don't have the same clear dividing line that you may have, for example, in the United States. Gibran would fluctuate between the two. His father was also, by the way, the same way. His father was a government minister at one stage. He was Lebanon's representative at the United Nations.
If this was, in fact, an act of intimidation, it's certainly blown up in the face of Syrian government. Has it, however, had its effect as an intimidator? Do you think journalists such as yourself will be cowed by the assassination?
Well, I don't think it was an act of intimidation. I think it was very simply an act of murder. I think that they wanted to get rid of Gibran Tweny. Their calculation was that if you get rid of Gibran, you essentially knock the main pillar out from under Al-Nahar, which has long been a thorn in the side of the Syrian regime. Now, in response to the second part, will people be cowed? Well, no, I don't think journalists are going to react to this, very simply because there is not much logic in what's taking place. There is a sense amongst many journalists that the Syrian regime has essentially taken a strategic decision that if it's going to go down because of the Hariri investigation, then it will take down as many of its enemies as it can.
There was a time, I suppose, maybe a decade ago, that if you could neutralize Al-Nahar, you could substantially eliminate a lot of the criticism of the Syrian regime. But this is a different world we're living in, with pan-Arab satellite networks, you know, all over the Middle East, especially Al Jazeera. You know, hasn't the blowback for Syria vastly overwhelmed any political advantage it may have gotten from silencing Gibran Tweny?
Well, I think we have to understand a few things. First of all, Syria has not been one of the strongest victims of the Arab satellite channels, especially channels like Al Jazeera, who tend to be more sympathetic to regimes like the Syrian regime. But we have to understand that Al-Nahar as well as, for example, the number one Lebanese television station, the Lebanese Broadcasting Corporation. These are essentially Syrian media. Syrians can watch Lebanese television, you know, without a satellite connection. An-Nahar, although it is not allowed into Syria, many Syrians download it from the internet, and they photocopy and they distribute it. And I think it's very important for the Syrian regime to ensure that the Lebanese media not serve as a platform that may undermine them domestically inside Syria.
Let me ask you one more question. You've already expressed the view that having murdered Hariri, the Assad regime is, you know, perfectly content to keep picking people off one at a time, because after all, in for a dime, in for a dollar. Now, you have been quite outspoken yourself against the Assad regime. Are you concerned that, you know, you're on the list?
Well, I hope I'm not. And, you know, it's a concern that all journalists have, many politicians have as well. There doesn't seem to be much rhyme or reason to who is picked off on a specific occasion. But the fact of the matter is that ultimately this is indeed proving disastrous to the Syrian regime. If anything, the Syrians have provoked a divorce between Lebanese and Syrian society that I think will take a long time to be repaired. I think also they've made it extremely difficult for their allies at the UN, for their allies inside Lebanon, to justify their alliances with Syria. Essentially, what I'm trying to say is I don't understand this policy in the long term. It doesn't make much sense to me.
All right, Michael. Well, once again, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Michael Young is opinion editor for the English language Daily Star in Beirut, Lebanon.
When Iraqis went to the polls this week, they had just finished a season of being polled exhaustively themselves. The latest such poll was commissioned by ABC and the BBC and was released Monday. It found that Iraqis are mostly happy with their personal lives, although fewer than half think their country is better off now than it was before the war. Skepticism about the war seems to span the region. In October, Zogby International and University of Maryland professor Shibli Telami surveyed thousands of people in Jordan, Lebanon, Morocco, Saudi Arabia, Egypt, and the United Arab Emirates. More than three-quarters of respondents thought that the Iraq invasion had brought more terrorism and less peace to the Middle East. But Zogby and Telami were interested not only in what the public opinion was, but how it was formed. And so they also asked people what TV channels they relied on for international news. Joining me now for a little analysis is Williams College professor Mark Lynch, who also authors the blog Abu Aardvark. Mark, welcome to the show.
Well, thanks for having me.
Al Jazeera dwarfed its competition as the first choice for international news, but that's not very surprising, is it?
No, that's not surprising. Al Jazeera has always been the most popular station and the one that the most people watch. And what's the most interesting number there actually is that only 10% say that they never watch it. Now, if you asked how many people actually like Al Jazeera the most, that number would be a lot lower. But the fact is that everybody has to watch Al Jazeera to know what's going on, and that's not true of any other station.
Something that I found really interesting was that Al Arabiya, which is the Saudi channel and which we've always regarded as an able competitor to Al Jazeera, actually fell quite behind Al Jazeera in terms of viewership.
I think there's two possible reasons for that. One is Al Arabiya tends to do a lot better in, say, Iraq and Kuwait, which were left out of the survey. But the other reason is that over the last year, Al Arabiya has been pushing a very pro-American agenda, which might be turning viewers off.
If you go down to the bottom of the list, to the American station Al Hara, 5% say they consider it the first or second choice for news. 53% say they never watch it ever.
I don't think Al Hara is really succeeding anywhere. Interestingly, the station with the profile that looks most like Al Hara's is the Hezbollah station Al Manar. It suggests to me that, like Al Manar, it's reaching a very small niche of like-minded people, but it's not breaking out into a wider audience.
So if you were going to Al Hara's sponsors in Washington, D.C., what would you tell them to do? Admit defeat and just close up shop?
I think they need to radically rethink the mission and try and figure out what it is that they're trying to achieve. Right now, they have a combination of NBA games and Inside the Actors Studio combined with news and talk shows, which frankly don't add very much to what's already out there. One of the things which has really bothered me about Al-Hurra and the way it's debated in Washington is that the Broadcasting Board of Governors seems to adopt a very boosterist position to it. They always want to flag the positive numbers and not really respond to the criticisms. And most independent observers look at it and say, something's not working. But when the response is, well, you're wrong, things are working, that's not very productive.
As far as media habits go, was there a widely different pattern of usage among the different nations?
There were some pretty significant differences. Al Jazeera, for example, in some places, it's almost a monopoly, whereas in other places, it's relatively weak. If you had thrown Iraq into the survey, that would have become even more stark, where Al Jazeera took sixth place in an Ipsos stat survey of television in Iraq done a few months ago. One thing which has been important for a number of years is that Iraqis and Arabs are really seeing a very different reality, and they're getting different news and they see things really differently. And this gap in perceptions between, you know, the general Arab world and Iraq, it seems to be, if anything, getting worse.
This poll is one of an increasing number of public opinion polls that are being conducted throughout the region. Do you think that the proliferation of these polls is changing the political landscape there, or merely tracking it?
I think that for these big cross-regional polls, the impact is more over on this side of the ocean. I think it tells us what Arabs think about us. But what has been much more interesting to me has been the proliferation of polls at the local level. Like in Jordan, for example, there's one independent newspaper which regularly commissions public opinion polls on domestic issues. And that's actually had quite an impact because it, in a sense, helps to break the stranglehold that opinion leaders or the government have on the agenda when a newspaper can say, look, what the people really care about is corruption, which maybe is something which columnists or the state-controlled media don't have any interest in pursuing. I think the real impact is going to be when we have 5 to 10 years of these under our belt and we can start tracking trends. And that, I think, is when we're going to start to see some real value in all of this public opinion polling.
All right. Mark, thank you very much.
And thanks for having me.
Mark Lynch is a political science professor at Williams College and the author of the new book, Voices of the New Arab Public, Iraq, Al Jazeera, and Middle East Politics Today.
Up next, the science projects you don't know you're eating, and tech experts who get gifts when they tell you what to buy for Christmas.
This is On the Media from NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. We are what we eat, but last month, a survey released by the Pew Initiative on Food and Biotechnology found that Americans don't really know what they're eating. According to Pew, the United States has planted more genetically modified, or GM, crops than any other country for more than a decade. In 2003, GM crops like corn, cotton, and soybeans covered 105.7 million acres of American farmland, yet despite years of worldwide debate, 58% of Americans polled were unaware of the GM food in their cupboard. Dr. Michael Fernandez is the executive director of the Pew Initiative. He says that while awareness of GM foods actually is up a little in the last year, attitudes have not changed.
Generally speaking, the attitudes towards genetically engineered foods in this country have remained fairly steady over the period of time that we've looked. there's a small portion of consumers who are adamantly opposed, and also relatively small portion of consumers that are strongly in favor. And the vast majority of consumers appear to be somewhere in the middle.
And the survey suggests that ignorance is bliss, or at least general complacency, while 50% of those who have heard about GM foods believe they've eaten them, only 15% of the group who hadn't heard of them believed they'd eaten them. So I guess we don't know what we don't know.
That's correct. It seems that there is some correlation between the awareness and knowledge and attitudes, although that correlation is not perfect across all questions that we've asked.
Do your findings correlate with what you see in the American press in terms of the amount of coverage?
I think that the amount of coverage has been, to my mind, relatively consistent with what the interest of the American people is. When there is some kind of controversy, there tend to be more stories, there tends to be more attention. In general, this is not an issue that is at the top of the mind of American consumers, and it's not an issue that's been, the top of the minds of the press.
Any thoughts on why this issue is so much bigger in Europe and Asia and Africa? I mean, just generally in the rest of the world?
Probably the predominant reason, at least that many people believe, is that American consumers tend to have a higher degree of confidence and trust in the regulatory system and in our food safety system. So let me just give you one example. In 2003, we did a poll where we asked the question, who do you trust for information about genetically engineered foods, genetically modified foods? And the number one vote getter, if you will, was the Food and Drug Administration. 83% of the people responding said that they trusted the FDA for information.
Dr. Michael Fernandez is the executive director of the Pew Initiative on Food and Biotechnology. Michael Pollan is director of the Knight Program in Science and Environmental Journalism at the University of California, Berkeley Graduate School of Journalism. I asked him why the GM food issue is such a non-issue in the U.S. press.
Basically, when it comes to a controversial issue, there has to be controversy for it to surface in the media. And the interesting thing about GMOs, genetically modified food, is one issue where both political parties were on the same side right from the get-go. And when you have two political parties in America agree on anything, the space for any kind of debate or politics essentially disappears. And the media is very much at the mercy of that situation. It's very hard for the media to cover an issue that the political parties are not fighting about or there aren't people in the streets about. And there are no people in the streets on this issue.
And I just wonder why they're in the streets in England, Italy, China, Brazil, around the globe, everywhere but here. Did we just not get the memo or what?
Well, no. The industry bought silence by essentially enlisting the support of both political parties. We have to go back to the history a little bit. Genetically modified food kind of comes up for consideration by the government at the end of the first Bush administration. Dan Quayle is put in charge of regulatory review. And at that point, they essentially decided that genetically modified food should have no regulation whatsoever. We should encourage it. There is something called substantial equivalence between genetically modified food and other food. And therefore, the new genes you're putting in or the new proteins the food is producing is not a food additive. Had they decided that those things were food additives, and by the way, they are food additives. They're new things that weren't in the food before. But sort of by fiat, they said, no, none of this stuff is substantially equivalent. So therefore, the FDA doesn't need to regulate it. Right at the end of this process, the Clinton administration comes in, and they're gung-ho for GMO food, too. So you had both parties essentially on board, and that is one sure way to make sure that Americans don't hear about something.
Now, Michael, I don't want to put you in the position of having to argue the science about this thing, but why so many people in the rest of the world are worried about it and we're not, it's still a puzzling issue. I mean, when you look
Sure.
at the Pew study, it does suggest that America has a thoroughgoing belief in its regulatory system. Americans seem to be under the impression that the FDA is looking out for us, but you're saying it isn't. It hasn't been asked to.
No, it's a misplaced confidence, frankly. The FDA is essentially not involved with most of these crops. And in fact, a lot of people don't realize that. Even when I was reporting on Monsanto, there were people there who'd say things to me like, well, It's the FDA's job to assure the safety of this stuff. It's our job to sell as much of it as possible. But in fact, it was the EPA that was regulating the crops in question. Why? Well, because essentially they're pesticides. These are crops that are designed to produce pesticides. So there's a lot of confusion actually about the way the regulation works. But your point is still a good one, which is that Americans generally are very confident in our regulators. They assume that this technology has really been looked at carefully, and they assume that there were all these kind of tests. But in fact, you know, those tests didn't really take place. That's not to say, I don't mean to raise an alarm, because I do think the Europeans can be really hysterical about this issue and have been, and they have their own reasons. And some of their reasons for objecting to GMOs are sound, and some of their reasons are simply protectionism. And some of them is it's an American technology and part of an American effort to, you know, take over the world's food supply. And that's how they see it. But we have much more confidence in our regulators, whether it's misplaced or not.
And of course, a big difference between Americans and Europeans is that they've been burned.
Well, yeah. I mean, the history of food regulation in Europe, I mean, you have mad cow disease and hoof and mouth disease that essentially destroyed Europeans' confidence in their regulators. And we have not had that experience. You know, could the media do a better job informing us about what we're eating and what's going on in our food supply? Sure. But it's very hard to do in the absence of a real political debate on the issue. Denis Kucinich is the last person in Congress to try to make an issue of genetically modified food. And he could not get co-sponsors on a bill to simply label the stuff, which, by the way, is the reason we don't know about it. It's not labeled.
We aren't generally as suspicious of new technology. We don't mind
No.
high-tech food.
Exactly right. You know, we love technology. We look at what we eat. We're the people who ate Elestra. You know, this is a fake fat. There are warnings on the labels that it causes anal leakage, and they still can sell this stuff. So I think that we have a very high threshold for what's going to alarm us about our food. Frankly, I think had the industry been able to come out and say, we're making this food, it's going to mean less pesticide, it's going to mean more nutrition, whatever, you know, promises they could make, I think we would have gotten on board.
But wait a minute, we have gone on board, haven't we?
Oh, yeah, but it's one thing to get on board, and it's another to just have it slipped into your food supply without knowing it.
Oh, right.
I wouldn't say we've gotten on board. This poll says that a majority of people are still unaware that they're eating this stuff. So, no, it's not fair to say we've gotten on board. I think it's more fair to say most of us don't really realize this is what we're eating. If we did realize, would we object? I'm not so sure. And the reason for that is we don't mind high-tech food by and large. If you can tell us that it's going to, you know, take the pounds off or taste really good or be really convenient. But the reason the industry could not make that argument is that their products essentially offer the consumer absolutely nothing. These are products designed to help farmers, allegedly.
If the FDA isn't actually watching over this, if Congress isn't actually watching over this, then doesn't it fall to the media, the mainstream media, to act as the watchdog?
Wouldn't it be wonderful? Yes. In my fondest dreams, the mainstream media would act on its own authority to question these kind of things, to engage in debate, and to counter the silence. I think that they need to come up with a different model. I mean, our model of kind of, on the one hand, on the other hand, journalism leaves you vulnerable that, you know, the news is essentially what politicians says is news, unless you're talking about natural disaster or tremendous protests in the street. We have planted 100 million acres to these new crops, taking a tremendous experiment with our ecosystem and possibly with our health without a thorough examination and thorough testing. That's a scandal. That is a scandal.
Well, Michael, thank you very much.
My pleasure, Brooke. Always good to be here.
Michael Pollan teaches journalism at the University of California at Berkeley. His new book, The Omnivore's Dilemma, A Natural History of Four Meals, will be out in April.
Christmas is only a week away, which means, beyond all the distractions about religion and spirituality, a bonanza for consumer electronics companies who are merrily, joyously trying to separate you from your money. But which device to buy? Digital cameras, MP3 players, cell phones. With so many choices, it's easy to see how sociologists came up with a term like option paralysis. But help is on the way. He's a tech expert and he's on your local news.
All of the computer smarts are in this pen.
And get out of here.
And it's an educational product from Leapfrog that is absolutely...
Gadget Guy Dave Matthews joins us now to talk about all kinds of good stuff.
Please go to 7online.com, look for the technology section, or email me, techguru@sri.net.
Techguru@sri.net.
What you won't learn from these segments is that some experts are paid by manufacturers to mention, favorably of course, certain products. We can tell you at least that the last man you heard was not on any gizmo manufacturer's payroll. He is Sri Srinivasan, a professor in the new media department at Columbia Graduate School of Journalism, and he joins us now. Sri, welcome to On the Media.
Delighted to be here.
All right, now we heard that little clip of you, which aired Thursday. We heard you not in your capacity as a college professor. What capacity were you in exactly?
I am the tech reporter for WABC-TV, which is the local ABC affiliate in New York. And I'm not an engineer, but I play one on TV, as I like to say. Basically, I report on technology. This time of the year, the biggest thing is what to get people for Christmas and, of course, Hanukkah, which is much later than in recent memory. So that means that holiday shopping season has been extended as well. So who better than a Hindu to help you out?
Christmas Hindus and Hindon'ts, I get the idea. But you are actually an employee of WABC. They pay you to do these reports, correct?
Correct. I am an employee of ABC and therefore of the Disney Corporation as well.
WABC is a big New York station with deep pockets, and it can afford to pay a tech expert to come on and tell me which MP3 player to buy. But other stations around the country aren't so deep pocketed, yet they still want a tech expert. How do they do it?
Some places have a local technology expert come in and do kind of independent analysis or expertise. Others use experts or segments that are pre-produced in other places.
Well, I guess the key word is independent. If he's on the payroll of a consumer electronics company, or he's getting paid in swag, free plasma TVs, or whatever they're compensating with, you as a viewer are not getting what you think you're getting.
There was an article in the Wall Street Journal this year that kind of blew the lid off this thing when they pointed out that at least one and maybe other people were being paid by computer companies and other gadget play people to kind of tout their wares on television. What I see is that a lot of local television stations have to fill the airtime and don't have a way of easily doing it. And so these prepackaged segments that sometimes come as satellite tours, interview opportunities, someone says they'll come to your TV station and for your Sunday morning show will show you the 10 hottest Christmas gifts. You almost need to do nothing and you get a guest in-house who will talk about it. That's very appealing to some people.
Yet, isn't it obvious to local stations that if someone's coming onto their air for free or supplying free video, that they're not doing it for the fun of it, that they're being compensated by someone and that therefore there's obviously going to be a conflict of interest?
It's an interesting question, but you have to remember that in television, there are people who do a lot for just the fun of it. A lot of the experts you see, a lot of the talking heads you see on television screaming at each other on those cable networks are doing it for free. It isn't always obvious that maybe someone is coming that they have an other agenda in addition to just the free FaceTime. So that could have been the culture that led to this problem.
But stations in their own ethics policies, aren't they required to find out what the relationship is between the so-called expert and the company whose products he's pitching?
There has been a lot of attention paid to this year, and I think as a result of it, people are now being asked to divulge their ties, what ties they might have. But also I want to point out that some people, for example, might have a celebrity chef come in from a local restaurant and show you how to cook a dish. That's kind of obvious that they are promoting their restaurant. That's okay. It's when the people who appear to be just gadget experts, that's where the trouble starts.
Do any of these PR people who you're dealing with ever communicate to you with a sort of wink and a nudge that if you want to keep the camera, enjoy it?
What I do have is occasionally people will call me from some agents of big companies or representative of big companies and ask me to host something at Las Vegas or be a spokesman for a lot of money. And there are journalists who, or tech experts who take on these jobs of kind of showing up at a convention and playing host and kind of doing mock television reporting, interviewing the CEO for an internal webcast or something like that. I've had several of those offers and have happily turned them down.
Okay. Well, Sri, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Sri Srinivasan is the tech expert for WABC-TV in New York City and Dean of Students at the Columbia Graduate School of Journalism.
Before there was a Senator John McCain, there was a Senator William Proxmire, a maverick Democrat from Wisconsin who died Thursday in Maryland. He was 90 years old. Elected in 1957 to fill the term vacated by the death of Senator Joseph McCarthy, he served for 32 years. Like McCain, Proxmire was a man who often stood apart from his party. Like McCain, he was a fierce advocate of campaign finance reform. And like McCain, he was a media darling. But unlike McCain, Proxmire attracted his headlines with stunts crafted with equal parts showmanship and conviction. Take his filibusters. One of them, against raising the ceiling of the national debt, lasted more than 16 hours. But it was his annual Golden Fleece Awards, conceived to ridicule government waste, that kept him in the news. There was the one bestowed for the government-funded study to learn if drunken fish are more aggressive than sober ones, the one for the $1 million grant to preserve a sewer as a historical monument, the one for the $200,000 program devoted to media literacy, or as he put it, to teach college students to watch television. Wait a minute, I like that one. And that was the problem with Proxmire. The Milwaukee Journal observed when he retired that Proxmire was a vigilant guardian of the public purse, but his love of publicity sometimes led him to take cheap shots as well, artfully ridiculing programs that actually deserved support. Still, there was no doubting his tenacity. In 1967, he vowed to give a speech every day until a convention against genocide was ratified in the Senate. 19 years and 3,211 speeches later, it was. What a wacky guy, as genocide expert Samantha Power once called him, and what a gift to reporters who never had to guess where he stood. He told them over and over again, and usually they put it in the paper.
Coming up, the year's top new words from the new Oxford American Dictionary and getting the boomer monkey off our culture's back.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the Kresge Foundation, investing in nonprofits to help them catalyze growth, connect to stakeholders, and challenge greater support. On the web at kresge.org. The Wallace Foundation, supporting ideas, sharing solutions, expanding opportunities. On the web at wallacefoundation.org. And the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, committed to helping Americans lead healthier lives and get the care they need. On the web at rwjf.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. The execution early Tuesday of convicted murderer and gang leader Stanley Tookie Williams was a made-for-TV drama. Here's Adam Housey of Fox News Channel with protesters' drums beating in the background, describing the scene.
There are all sorts of media here, as you might imagine, from all over the world, television, radio, and also now with the internet, you've got all sorts of different organizations out here, people that have a certain political opinion.
Opinions, of course, but this event was more than the usual skirmish in the culture wars. Because as made-for-TV dramas go, this one had a celebrity cast. The condemned man was the founder of the notorious Crips, a gangster-turned-children's book author preaching against crime and violence. His supporters included the Reverend Al Sharpton, actors Mike Farrell and Jamie Foxx, even rapper-actor Snoop Dogg.
Stanley Tookie Williams is not just a regular old guy. He's an inspirator. He inspires me.
So there was an inspirator and a terminator. Fictional executioner Arnold Schwarzenegger, now the clemency-denying governor of California, uncomfortably playing himself.
They're all very difficult decisions to make. You know, that's just being part being governor.
More than just drama, this was a morality play. There was evil, there was vengeance, there was Jesse Jackson speaking of redemption.
Obviously, very disappointed that the governor has missed a moment to choose life over death, has missed a moment to choose redemption over revenge.
And Fox's Sean Hannity, in a tussle with Sharpton, literally shouting for justice.
Reverend, this
again,
all turns
what
on.
What is the greater good? The governor needs to explain to young people that it is more important that this guy be killed out of revenge than to spend the rest
justice.
Of his life in jail.
Justice.
No one's saying
here's
send him home.
Here's
but
the issue.
Let
this
him
all
continue to do.
The story was illustrated again and again with images of the prisoner in various stages of life. Images presumably meant to put a human face to the allegory, but mainly aired without explanation. No scandal there, exactly. Television, after all, is all about images. But the episode reminds us that drama does not necessarily yield enlightenment, that allegory by soundbite is not the same as truth. What from all these passionate declarations did we learn about our society, much less about justice or redemption? What we did learn, finally, was that at 12:35 a.m. Pacific Standard Time Tuesday, Stanley Williams was pronounced dead. For the rest, TV just wasn't up to the task. Have you ever encountered a life hack? Do you know what it means to be squicked? These were all runners-up for the coveted distinction of the New Oxford American Dictionary's 2005 Word of the Year. Those and a bunch of other neologisms you've never heard of will be included in the next online update of the dictionary due out early next year. Erin McKean is the New Oxford American Editor-in-Chief, and she joins me now to explain the difference between an IDP and an IED. Erin, welcome to OTM.
Thank you.
Erin, the New Oxford American Word of the Year 2005, I'm happy to report, is one very near and dear to the soul of this radio program. Drum roll, please. The word is
podcast. I'm really happy to think that maybe in a very meta way, people are hearing that podcast is the word of the year on a podcast. That would be really cool, wouldn't it?
Tell me, according to the New Oxford American Dictionary, what's a podcast and how it wound up as Word of the Year?
We define a podcast as a digital recording of a radio broadcast or a similar program made available on the internet for downloading to a personal audio player. I really wanted to put podcast into the print edition that came out earlier this year, but we just didn't have enough evidence for it. And then about, 3 weeks after our print deadline, the word just blew up. It was everywhere. And so when it came time to choose the word of the year, I was a staunch advocate for podcast. And now everybody and their uncle has a podcast.
Okay, thank you, fine, sure, to value what we do. So has technology always been a driving force behind bringing new words into the lexicon?
It's hard to say whether technology is really the driving force or whether it's some kind of observer paradox in that it's very easy for us to find technology words. Because where do people discuss technology? They do it on the internet, and the internet's very easy to search. Words that don't get talked about on the internet are harder to find. That doesn't mean we aren't looking for them. It just means that we have a lot of evidence from the technology arena and less evidence about, say, terms of cat breeding or surfer talk or stuff like that.
Aaron, have you ever been squicked by something? And what question have I just asked? Because I actually have no idea.
You have just asked whether I have been immediately revolted by something.
Where does this come from? It sounds kind of like surfer parlance.
I actually cannot say on the radio where this word came from, because somebody sent me a link to a Usenet news group called alt.tasteless, which should give you an idea of why I can't talk about the etymology of this word on the radio. But, you know, Google is out there and it will be a friend to you if you want to find out.
All right. Well, I'd like to tell you that I just don't even want to know, but
you don't want to know.
I really do. So as soon as we're done with this, I'm going to, in journalism circles, a hack is a pejorative term, but what about a life hack? And where does that come from?
Computer geeks think of hacks as generally good things. They make stuff work in a better way, possibly not the way the original manufacturers intended, whereas non-computer people see the word hacker and they have very negative connotations. So a life hack is any kind of little trick that you use to make something work more efficiently or to do something more effectively. For instance, a very simple life hack is to pick one place for your keys and never put them anywhere other than that.
It's a solution to a persistent
problem. It's kind of like a very geeky kind of hints from Heloise.
Okay. Aaron, after World War II, the acronym DP for displaced persons was very popular and quickly became, as many descriptives do, offensive to those who had emigrated here to escape persecution because it became stigmatized. What is an IDP, and when did that shorthand creep into the language?
IDP is actually pretty old. We have citations from the 30s, but it came to prominence this past year when there was that big controversy over whether you could tell people who had been affected by Hurricane Katrina, whether you could call them evacuees or refugees. And both of those terms became stigmatized. And so IDP, which is much more bureaucratic, was used instead.
And it stands for?
Internally displaced person.
Now, we promised an explanation of the difference between IDP and IED. Aaron, what's IED?
An improvised explosive device. IED is a word that really owes its place on this list to the war in Iraq.
One more question. If I were to throw an iPod in Times Square, am I likely to hit someone who knows what in the world reggaeton is?
I'm pretty sure you would be able, depending on your aim. It's a Latin American dance music, which is getting a lot of play here, and it combines elements of reggae with hip-hop and rap. It's pretty catchy, I have to say.
Thank you very much for joining us.
Oh, you're very welcome. Thank you.
Aaron McKean is the editor-in-chief of the New Oxford American Dictionary, where in its 2006 updated version online, you'll find all of the words we just talked about, and no doubt quite a few more.
Reggaeton may rock the house, but will it move product? It's baby boomers who have long been the nation's biggest consumers, so when advertisers want to sell something, from orange juice to electronics, they've tended to rely on oldies like these.
I've got to admit, it's getting better.
But advertisers are beginning to change their tune because, as Slate columnist Jack Schaefer notes, while still the largest single generation, the boomers are steadily dying off, or at least going to pasture. He says, quote, they peaked as a percentage of the population in 1980 at 35% and currently stand at about 27%, or 77 million self-absorbed individuals. But sooner or later, the post-boomers will give them the necessary nudge, push, and shove to sweep their rotting culture from the scene. It may seem like the boomers have ruled the culture forever, But Schaefer says there was a moment when they seized power, though people may differ on exactly when that was.
My friend Glenn Garvin, who's now the TV critic for the Miami Herald, said it happened in the spring of 1977. He was in his mid-20s. He was lounging at home on a Sunday afternoon, and a coworker, his same age, called him from the news desk at the Austin American-Statesman, trying to write a headline for a drought that had been visiting the Austin area. So he called Garvin, and he wanted to confirm the lyrics to the Temptations' 1967 hit, I Wish It Would Rain. Glenn proceeded to confirm the lyrics, and he wrote the headline, Sunshine, Blue Skies, Please Go Away. Well, it was a fantastic headline, and the editor expected a commendation, a raise, or at least a cup of coffee on Monday when he came into work. Instead, his bosses yelled at him for trivializing the front page of the Austin American-Statesman with rock and roll lyrics that no one would get. Glenn thinks that that was sort of a turning point for him. After 1977, he started to spot all sorts of boomer references to boomer culture, boomer movies, boomer rock and roll, boomer lit, everywhere. And the boomers have basically stayed in the driver's seat ever since, I think.
I guess I peg it to quite a bit later. I remember saying to myself when Jay Leno took over for Johnny Carson, now is the time for the boomers. But by then, I guess it was well underway.
Yeah, I think you were a little late to the party. But...
So then, are now the post-boomers finding a voice?
Well, the post-boomers are trying to edge their way in, but as you know probably from looking around your newsroom, boomers don't want to retire, don't really want to go anywhere if they have any positions of power, and so they'll probably have to be shot and drawn and quartered and dragged out and buried in shallow graves in the Sonoran Desert before we're rid of them.
But in the meantime, as the post-boomers find a voice, we're finding examples of crossover. You note the Lee Iacocca Snoop Dogg Chrysler commercial. So what does that say about the battle between the generations?
I think it means that post-boomers have to go deeper into post-boomer culture to get a hold of references that post-boomers aren't going to get. I mean, boomers are omnivores. They'll glom onto the World War II generation's culture if they think that they can milk it. So what I think will happen is it'll be when you're on vacation, Brooke, and somebody in their late 20s, rather than somebody like you who's in their late 60s, does these segments. And all of a sudden there'll be references, I think, to some of the generation's favorite movies. As much as we may be cinemaniacs, when we were growing up, we were never able to see our favorite movie 5, 6, 7 times in one day. The way that post-boomers are. So post-boomers have seen movies like The Breakfast Club.
Come on, answer the question. Don't be a jerk.
It's easy. It's only one question.
No! I never did it!
Or Ferris Bueller's Day Off.
Bueller. Bueller. Bueller.
Heather's Dazed and Confused, to cite a new movie, Napoleon Dynamite.
If you need to use any of my skills, I can do whatever you want.
Thanks. If I win, you could be my secretary or something.
Sweet.
They'll see these movies over and over and over until they sort of carve spaces in their brains. And I think they'll dig real deep into the dialogue of these movies and references to these movies to just blow us away with headlines we don't understand.
Well, you see, I guess that's the problem. The baby boomers want to stay young. They also have DVD players. So I can quote the entire dialogue to The Big Lebowski and even Ferris Bueller's Day Off because I like those movies. So is it a question of whether or not I get the reference or whether the reference is designed for me to get and not somebody younger?
I would say that you would probably not be so good on references to video games and rap music.
Right.
There's a popular old school Nintendo game called Contra,
mm-hmm.
and every post-boomer knows the reference up, up, down, down, left, right, BA, start, which is how you get to the sort of cheat page of that game to sort of master it.
Right.
Every post-boomer is going to know that. Or they'll know dialogue from Grand Theft Auto. And as on top of the post-boomer culture as you try to be, you just don't have enough hours in the day to master it.
When you address this in your column, you threw up to your readers the question, what post-boomer reference in a mass media headline or TV commercial will signal the cultural coup? So what did you get? And you left out Seinfeld, Saturday Night Live, REM, maybe The Simpsons.
I didn't include any of those cultural touchstones because they are too shared by boomers and post-boomers.
Mm-hmm.
But where the post-boomers can go that the boomers will never follow is when they engage in their slang. Words like chewy or crunk or crashy. Things that you couldn't even begin to define for yourself, Brooke. One of my readers, Elizabeth Tarski, suggested that we'd see a lot of headlines that contain content that might be drawn from IMs or text messages.
Mm-hmm.
The shortening, wanna, gonna, need to, and abbreviations like OMFG, which would include some of these censored words that we can't say on the radio.
Or LOL, laugh out loud.
LOL, but LOL, I think, is, you'd find that in a Dilbert comic strip. So gong, that would not include, Brooke.
Fair enough.
I got a lot of mail on this with suggested headlines. The one that was the most frequently suggested would be some variation on all your base are belong to us.
Right.
Do you know what that means?
Actually, I did receive that in the mail about 3 years ago, and I know it relates to some badly translated Japanese video game.
This is famous. You can find websites devoted to this mistranslation. So I think a lot of readers had a great faith in video games being this sort of cultural well that post-boomers could constantly draw from to sort of go, nya, 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 we've taken over.
All right, Jack, late bro. I'm outie.
23 Skidoo.
Jack Schaefer writes the Press Box column.
You see us as you want to see us. In the simplest terms, with the most convenient definitions. But what we found out is that each one of us is a brain.
And an athlete.
And a basket case. A princess.
And a criminal.
Does that answer your question?
Won't you come see about me? I'll be alone, dancing, you know it, baby. Tell me your troubles and doubts, giving me everything inside and out. And
that's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Megan Ryan, Tony Field, Jamie York, and Mike Vuolo, and edited by Brooke. Dylan Keefe is our technical director and Jennifer Munson, our engineer. We had help from Katie Holt and Kevin Schlodman. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Catcher Rogers is our senior producer and John Keefe, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and find free transcripts, MP3 downloads, and our podcast at onthemedia.org and email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. This is On the Media from WNYC. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
A basket case.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
The criminal.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people. Online at wtgrantfoundation.org. The W.K. Kellogg Foundation, from vision to innovative impact, 75 years of philanthropy. And the Charles Stuart Mott Foundation, online at mott.org, supporting efforts to promote a just, equitable and sustainable society. Support from the media comes from the Bidell Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR. Thanks for checking out this week's On the Media from WNYC, New York Public Radio. This podcast is made possible by WNYC and its listeners. Please help support this free service by becoming a member at wnyc.org. And thanks.
Since WNYC's first broadcast in 1924, we've been dedicated to creating the kind of content we know the world needs. Since then, New York Public Radio's rigorous journalism has gone on to win a Peabody Award and a DuPont Columbia Award, among others. In addition to this award-winning reporting, your sponsorship also supports inspiring storytelling and extraordinary music that is free and accessible to all. To get in touch and find out more, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.